start with a general question about what the idea of a national health service is. I mean, what does it sort of spring from, do you think, in its very simplest ways? I mean,
I think the health service springs obviously from the fact that society is now in a position economically to afford an adequate health service. Some optimist is said apocryphally to have said at the beginning of the First World War that it'll be over in a few days because the powers will run out of money. This clearly was not the case. There is an enormous amount of wealth available if it's mobilized. And the second development which has led to the formation of the health service is the technical advances in medicine. At one time it perhaps didn't matter too much whether the doctor saw the patient or not, because there was little he could offer beyond solace. But with improvements in medical care and treatment, successes like the development of proper treatment of diabetes was an early example, and then later the sulfonamides and the antibiotics coming along, it became a matter of life and death whether a proper service was afforded or not. And clearly this is, in everybody's view, desirable that there should be an effective service. And it is also clear to those of us who have pressed for the formation of a national health service that the resources are available if the powers that be are willing to place them at the disposal of such a service.
Could you just say something then about, I mean, just from your own history as to when you were a medical student and then into the 20s and 30s and up towards the Second World War, how you came to see, out of your own experience, the development of this service, particularly in relation to dealing with, as it were, a class society, in other words, a society where the incidence of disease did seem to be class-specific in certain very clear ways?
As a medical student, I was faced with the constantly recurring problem that the voluntary hospital in which I studied was continually under threat of closure. There was a large board exhibiting the financial state of the hospital for the public to read, and the situation was always critical. Resources were very limited. Beds overflowed into corridors and places that were not designed for patients. The one of the wards of the hospital was taken over by the local mental hospital run on a municipal basis, because in spite of the recurring crisis within the London County Council's economy, they were in a slightly better state than the voluntary hospital. The dependence on the class situation was always present, and large numbers of people attended outpatients at the voluntary hospital in order to get a free service, which they were not entitled to from their GP for various reasons. In diabetic practice, which I was initially interested on after my qualification, the people were unable to afford the prescribed diet because they normally lived on cheap carbohydrates, so that they couldn't afford the inclusion of meat and other more costly foods. An illustration which stands out in my memory just after I qualified was being called out in a brief period of as GP, and being called out at night to deliver a twin pregnancy, and the mother being glad when the babies died soon after delivery, because it would have been two extra mouths to feed. That was the background of the situation, and clearly in a society with the resources which even then were available, the place for those babies to have been born would have been the obstetric unit, where every care could have been provided, though perhaps not at the standard which is available at the present day.
So how then, I mean, given your actual experience of these matters, did you begin to become involved with, as it were, the political process towards agitation and pressure as part, in your own biographical experience of the development of the service?
I became involved in the Socialist Medical Association together with other colleagues at the 1936-1938 period, when again I was working in a background of extreme financial limitation for the service which we were supposed to be running. And I was concerned locally with trying to improve the quality of the service within the hospital, and more generally to make available the resources of modern medicine to the large numbers of people within the country to whom they were not then available.
So what did the SMA actually do? What could you just tell us? I mean, after all, you've described this experience, you're working away, and you're now also becoming part of a political pressure. What did it actually
do? Well, we put before the public, before the Labour Party, before the other interested parties, the need for a medical service which would meet contemporary demands, which would serve the bulk of the population adequately in all respects. We wanted to unify the fragmentary services which existed in the way of the panel system, the municipal hospitals, the voluntary hospitals, the departments of the medical officers of health, and other aspects of the existing services which as they were then. And then the war came along with the emergency medical service, and a large proportion of the population became entitled to a full medical service in the armed forces or in other services, so that by the end of the war, there was relatively little political disagreement as to the need for a health service. It was accepted by both major parties that this was a reasonable proposition.
So, that's most interesting. But the question it poses, as it were, is who didn't want it? If you see what I mean. Now, that sounds rather odd, but obviously the SMA is putting pressure on in a particular time in the 30s and so on, and communist doctors are developing this political position. What's interesting about the history of the National Health Service is that you could explain its genesis in a rather sort of conflict-free way, that roughly speaking, everybody sort of wants it. It's a question of what terms are going to be struck, and the role of the war in actually generating that overall agreement, as it were, does seem very, very important. I mean, do you think the political pressure in the 30s was actually decisive, or was it things like the war and everybody agreeing they needed it, if you see what I mean?
Certainly it was the war and everybody agreeing that they needed it. This was a time of change. People in authority and in privileged positions realized that they would have to give way to a considerable extent to satisfy the public demand. And it was not really a question as to whether there should be a health service or not, but how much should be afforded in the way of resources and how precisely the health service would be structured.
That's very good. And on precisely on that, could you tell us a little bit about how you saw things going in 46, 48, in terms of how the cake was going to be cut up? I mean, from your own political perspective, from the 30s particularly, how did the battle look when it really came to it in sort of in the post-war period? I mean, some detail.
Ever since the beginning of the health service, we seem to have been in a situation of make do and mend. We've taken over existing fragmentary services and added to them and reshaped them to some extent. To some extent, there's been a centralized effort to improve the facilities for the underprivileged areas and underprivileged classes. But we're left with the fact that these aims have not been achieved, and there still are underprivileged areas of the country and underprivileged classes in regard to health care. We've never really fundamentally planned the service. It's always been a question of postponing major revisions until tomorrow, and that tomorrow still looks as distant as ever.
I'm sure you're right. Does the fine detail of the battles of the 40s, of 46, 48, bring out contradictions within the history of the service which are still visible? I mean, do you think the contradictions, as it were endemic in the actual act itself and the pressures that had come from various quarters at that time? Is that one of the reasons that the thing is still half?
Yes, the position of the general practitioner is clearly one area where there have been disagreements and difficulties, and many general practitioners were working from premises which were ill-equipped for the purpose and made limited contact with other local services. It's only gradually that we've switched over to the notion of the group practice with proper facilities, proper building, and good relationships with local clinics, which are often held in the same building. But GPs have traditionally been anxious about their situation and anxious to preserve the degree of independence which they have. This is understandable and natural, but at the same time, many of them are now willing to go along with the notion of the need for better premises and group practices and for working integrally with the service.
So just to ask it, I mean, in again a way, but very much more simply, given your own history, how did you feel about the act when it came to be enacted? I mean, how did it seem to you after those early years of sort of both experience and political feelings as an achievement in itself? Who would you praise? What is your feeling about Bevan, for example? How much was it a political as against an organizational achievement? And what was unsatisfactory? Because in some sense it must have been, there must have been unsatisfactory elements to it, and these contradictions now have always remained in some way, particularly in relation to the GP.
Obviously, the introduction of the health service was a great victory. It was a victory for common sense, and it brought the country a little more up to date in regard to medical services. It made provision for the whole population. So in these senses, it was a great advance. Yes, so there are many criticisms one can make about the health service, and there have been since its foundation. For example, the industrial health service was not included, and this has been a constant complaint by those in the Socialist Medical Association and in other similar organizations. The major difficulty has been that the health service took on responsibilities, as I said, and hasn't been ever in a position to reorganize these from the word go. There's been no fresh look, by and large, at the responsibilities which were taken over. And the amount of resource made available has always been too limited, spread too thin, and spread over to cover the responsibilities which were inherited when the service was inaugurated.
So in some sense, the crisis, which seems, as it were, not to go away in the NHS and somehow to be now very marked, is one that springs from a simple lack of correct funding, I mean, an insufficient funding by the state. And you think that was there from, within the formal organisation from the beginning?
From the beginning. One could make particular criticisms from the democratic angle in the sense that there wasn't adequate local representation on the management committees and other bodies which existed. And this is even more so after reorganization. But whether it's the hospital management committee or the district health organization, the basic problem is one of limited funds, constantly being told to reduce the amount spent on overtime, being unable to repair buildings and so on. These buildings in this hospital were here from 1939, which is not so long ago as such places go, but were constantly in difficulties because ordinary basic repairs and maintenance can't be carried out. And we're in similar difficulties in regard to employment of occupation therapists and nurses and other members of the staff.
And well, before we go on to something else, just to complete that thought, how would you generalize that thought? In other words, does the service reflect the contradictions of a mixed economy in general? As you say, most interestingly, resources are certainly around. We can see that in the current situation. From your own account, it was, from your point of view, true even in the 20s, as it were. But somehow, there's been a bottleneck. There hasn't been this full-scale funding of a social public health scheme. Is that a reflection of the fact that the economy itself has never been fully socialized?
Yes, I'm sure that this is so. The resources do exist. We spend vast amounts of money on self-destruction or preparation for such. We spend vast amounts of money on things like tobacco and alcohol. We all, despite everything, live somewhat better than we did 50 years ago. The resources are available. It's only the political will to devote an adequate share to the health service which prevents such service being created.
Well, then perhaps we could just sort of finish off in a more sort of reflective way on the current situation, the last 20 years, let us say. Apart from the things you've evoked very strongly, continual decay, as it were, within this service as a public service, what other things have happened over the last 20-year period, for example, which have deepened the difficulties, do you think? I mean, have things become quite hard, given, for example, the growth in the private sector, particularly over the last 5 years, that now seems particularly one notices in London to be really sort of, I believe it's the biggest growth industry in the capital, in private medicine. What's new, do you think, or what's becoming more pronounced as a difficulty with the relation between public and private in the modern period, in the very recent past? Has the private sector come right back into a sort of blooming health as the sick child of state medicine has struggled along?
Well, it's still true that the bulk of the work in the service is done by the public service, the public health service, and it still is the case that it's only the cream financially which is skimmed off by the private sector. It's difficult to judge the relative efficiency of the two aspects of health service, but it seems reasonable to conclude from all the evidence available that the public health service in this country, despite all the criticisms, is probably more cost efficient than any health services in any other country.
That's interesting. In fact, the point about cost efficiency has been made by some of the other people we've spoken to. What also seems possible is something more cruel, if you like, which is that the NHS is becoming a publicly supported, almost safety cushion or a safety net, you might say, which the private sector can use, say, high technological devices can be employed. It can be used as a sort of lender of last resort, if you like, to a growing private sector. And in some way, what's happening in the very modern period is that it subsidizes the private sector in some curious way. So the private sector can use public resources when it chooses, while going on under international funding, amongst other things, to flourish in a very new and sort of striking way. I mean, buildings come up all the time, and more for private practice. So, has the contradiction which has always been there now become really quite acute in the sense that the NHS actually subsidises the private world?
Yes, I'm sure this is entirely true. One point which I would like to mention is the question of research. Any well-run business of this kind should devote considerable proportion of its resources to research to be efficient, and the health service does of course support research to a degree which is entirely, in my view, quite inadequate. However, such research as is done within the public health service, and the results are made available free, as it were, to the private service.
So that is one example of a free service. And one might look, for example, as you will know more than myself, but I mean the enormous drug bill. And in that sense, the contradiction is again exposed that the public are, as it were, paying the drug companies.
Yes.
I mean, do you feel particularly, given your own current your current practice, do you feel particularly upset about the position of the private pharmaceutical companies in relation to the NHS? Do they seem to be really very much at an advantage over it?
This has been a problem with the Socialist Medical Association, with Dr. Stark Murray and other members like Somerville Hastings from the beginning, long before the health service was created. And it's a thing which one must feel strongly about when one sees the very limited resources available to the public health service. And when colleagues are going off to exotic place for a conference at the expense of the health service, this is all unplanned and is clearly an effort by the pharmaceutical firms to market their wares. I was delighted to see the introduction of the national formulary, which for the first time gives a critical assessment of critical and comparative assessment of the value of drugs. But even so, this is small weight against the tons of commercial literature which pours through doctors' letterboxes.
Well, we're nearly finished, I think. But perhaps, I mean, a general reflection on, I mean, if you feel like answering, which I'm sure reasons for not, but do you feel pessimistic at the end of a very sort of long career? I mean, do you feel that things are slipping away, it is running down, BUPA is booming, some trade unions seem to actually favour the private sector, although their general policy seems to be, as it were, the abolition of the private sector, there do seem some anomalies in that. I mean, do you feel that politically, as against your youth, that there has been some move away from the socialistic commitment that, the SMA...
On the contrary, I'm sure that the future is with the National Health Service. I'm sure that we are in a temporary difficulty only, and that the early enthusiasm for the private sector will be hedged about by the enormous difficulties that it will run into. The future of the health service lies with the general political solution and the proper resources can only be available if economic problems are solved more generally, if the social services generally can be supported, and if we can somehow arrive at a saner world where we're not faced with the constant threat of destruction.